looking at the holes in her stockings. When she was settled and comfortable, he gathered wood and kindling for the fire. Dorothy just watched. She didn't have the energy to move. She didn't have a thought in her head. Slowly, the warmth of the stove began to penetrate her skin. Then Miss Larson arrived.
"What's this?" she asked.
She unwrapped her lavender scarf and took off her hat and gloves. Kneeling beside Dorothy's chair, she said,
"Goodness, child!"
Mr. Post was putting on his hat and gloves.
"She was asleep out there on the porch when I arrived," he said. "Scared the bejesus out of me. Well, I'm off to get the others."
As soon as he left in the truck, Miss Larson said,
"Now then, tell me what happened."
And Dorothy did. She had not been planning to tell more than she had to, but her teacher's friendly brown eyes were so sharp with concern that everything came tumbling out. Mrs. Grote lying in bed all day, Mr. Grote in the woods, the moldy old mattresses and holes in the floor, the children squalling with hunger. Dorothy told her about how Mrs. Grote had called her a filthy Irish bog trotter. She told her about the long walk in the dark to the schoolhouse. "If I didn't have the mittens, a kind woman, a fanny, made for me at the last place, I don't know what I would have done." Miss Larson put her hand over Dorothy's and left it there, squeezing every now and then.
"Oh, my poor girl," she said.
And then,
"Thank goodness for the mittens. Fanny sounds like a good friend."
She was. Miss Larson cocked her head.
"Who brought you to the Grotes?"
"Mr. Sorensen from the Children's Aid Society."
"All right. When Mr. Post gets back, I'll send him out to find this Mr. Sorensen."
Opening her lunch pail, she pulled out a biscuit.
"You must be hungry."
Normally, Dorothy would refuse. She knew this was Miss Larson's lunch, but the hunger inside her was so fierce that she couldn't say no. She seized the biscuit and devoured it in three bites. Miss Larson heated water on the stove for tea and cut an apple into slices, arranging them on a chipped china plate from a shelf. She poured the tea into cups, added sugar, and brought them over. The worst of her hunger tamed now, Dorothy could pick up an apple slice in trembling fingers and eat it, slowly. The sweetness made her eyes water. "Miss Larson," she said,
"could you ever, would you ever?"
Dorothy couldn't finish. It was too much to ask, she knew. But she couldn't help wanting it.
"Take you home to live with me?"
Miss Larson asked gently. Dorothy nodded, a lump in her throat so large that she couldn't swallow the bite of apple in her mouth. She looked away from her teacher, away from the sadness she could already see in her eyes.
"I care about you, Dorothy. I think you know that," Miss Larson said. "But I can't. I'm in no position to take care of a girl. I live in a boarding house."
Dorothy nodded, not looking up.
"I will help you find a home," her teacher said. "A place that is safe and clean, where you'll be treated like a 10-year-old girl. I promise you that."
Maybe Dorothy should have been happy to hear Miss Larson's promise. Somewhere safe and clean. Somewhere she did not have to sew all day long. Somewhere she'd be fed and warm. It should have sounded like heaven. But even more than heaven, what she wanted at that moment was for Miss Larson to put her arms around her. To take her home, to live with her. To love her like her own child. But that wasn't what she was going to get. Dorothy put a shaky hand out to her teacup and gulped the hot tea, trying to melt the knot in her throat. The other children came in, and Dorothy took her seat beside Lucy. Miss Larson talked quietly to Mr. Post, and he went out again. In a kind of daze, Dorothy copied what Lucy did, getting out her spelling primer, opening to the right page, lining up behind her to write on the board. Lucy squeezed her hand. "Are you all right?" Dorothy nodded. But it was a lie. She wasn't all right. She was still cold, still tired, still hungry. She didn't have a home to go to. And no matter what Miss Larson had promised, she was afraid that maybe she never would. Chapter 15. Molly, Spruce Arbor, Maine, present day. In the kitchen at Ralph and Dina's on Saturday morning, Molly spoons up the last of her raisin bran. She rinses off the bowl and puts it in the dishwasher, careful to leave no extra work for Dina. Looking out through the window, she spots Dina outside, raking one of the flower beds.
Molly's surprised. She's never seen Dina in the garden. She wanders outside to see what she's doing. Heaps of dead leaves are lying on the grass. In the newly bare earth, little green sprouts are poking up. "What are those?" Molly asks. "Crocuses," Dina answers, not looking up. "Oh, yeah. My mom and I used to plant those every spring."
Did she actually say that? And to Dina, of all people?
But the memory rose up so suddenly and vividly that the words just popped out. Every Easter, when Molly was little, she went to St. Anne's Church with her parents. There was a big table in front of the sanctuary, covered with crocuses and little pots wrapped in silver foil. Molly would pick the one she liked best, and she and her mom would plant it in the cold mud beside the driveway. A cluster of crocuses bloomed there every spring, white and purple and gold.
"How about you help me, then? You like cleaning up?" Dina pushes the rake at Molly. "Why don't you go get the leaves off that other bed?"
Molly hesitates.
"I've never raked before. No big trick to it."
Dina lets go of the rake, so Molly has to grab it.
"Just pull the leaves off. You need to let the sunlight touch the earth."
Dina heads to the garage. Molly walks slowly over to the other flower bed and tentatively uses the rake to pull a clump of soggy brown leaves onto the grass. Molly thinks of Mary Lennox and her friend, Dickon, shut inside the walled and secret garden, weeding and digging, giving the neglected flowers a chance to flourish. She likes the idea that she's doing the same thing. Okay, it's just Ralph and Dina's yard, which is small and only has two flower beds and some discouraged-looking yew bushes. It's not exactly the formal garden of Misselthwaite Manor, but still. She rakes harder, thinking about the book. Dina comes out of the garage, trundling a wheelbarrow in front of her.
"What are you doing?"
Dina is suddenly next to her, grabbing the rake out of her hand. Molly blinks at her.
"Raking? Like you said, you have to be gentle."
Molly looks down at the rake to see several shreds of green tangled among its teeth. She's pulled a crocus up by the roots.
"Oh, sorry," she mumbles.
Dina sighs.
"It's all right. I'll do it myself."
Dorothy, Hemingford County, Minnesota, 1930. Later in the afternoon, while all the children were copying math from the board, a dark green Chrysler pulled up into the schoolyard behind Mr. Post's truck. Out the window, Dorothy could see Mr. Sorensen walking toward the schoolhouse, taking off his black felt hat. Miss Larson greeted him at the door and spoke quietly for a moment. Then she turned back to the students and clapped her hands.
"All right, everyone, let's take a break. It's a beautiful day. You can have 10 minutes outside. Dorothy, you stay in here with me."
She led Mr. Sorensen to a chair near the stove and asked Dorothy to explain to him exactly what had happened. Dorothy twisted her fingers together and looked down at them. Telling Miss Larson had been one thing. She'd been sure her teacher would understand. Mr. Sorensen, though? Miss Larson nodded at Dorothy.
"Start with last night," she suggested gently.
"I was looking after Harold," Dorothy began. "He had, I'm afraid, there were lice in his hair." She glanced up quickly enough to see an expression of distaste cross Mr. Sorensen's face. He looked like he wanted to inch his chair away from her. "And Mrs. Grote said, she said I'd brought them into the house, and she called me." She didn't want to repeat the words.
"My, my,"
Mr. Sorensen said when Dorothy had finished her story. He stroked his mustache.
"Such a long walk in the cold. You must have been very..."
His voice trailed off.
And yet, I wonder."
Dorothy's heart started to beat more quickly. He looked at Miss Larson.
"A 10-year-old girl. Don't you find, Miss Larson, that there can be a certain... excitability? A tendency to exaggerate, perhaps?"
"It depends on the girl, Mr. Sorensen," she said stiffly, lifting her chin. "I have never known Dorothy to lie."
Chuckling, he shook his head.
"Ah, Miss Larson, that's not at all what I meant. I merely meant that sometimes children, well, they take things very much to heart, and in a few days, all's well again." Now, I'm sure there was a disagreement, voices raised, perhaps. It does happen, and of course I saw with my own eyes that the Groats household, well, it is not, perhaps, an ideal situation, but very few of us have perfect families, do we? And when we are dependent on the charity of others, we are not always in a position to complain.
He smiled at Dorothy.
I think you should go back. Give it another try.
She told me to get out,
Dorothy whispered slowly, the words like icy pebbles on her tongue. Miss Larson's eyes were glittering and a red flush had crept up her neck.
Did you hear the girl, Mr. Sorensen? She asked. Surely you don't expect Dorothy to return to that situation. Frankly, I wonder why you don't ask the police to go out there and take a look. It doesn't sound like a healthy place for the other children either.
Mr. Sorensen was nodding. Slowly.
Well, then, you see, if Dorothy isn't willing to return, we're in a bit of a pickle. There are no families that I know of at the moment seeking orphans. I could inquire, of course, contact the Children's Aid in New York. If it comes down to it, Dorothy could go back there, I suppose, on the next train that comes through.
Surely, we won't need to resort to that, Miss Larson said. He gave a little shrug.
One would hope not. One doesn't know.
Miss Larson put her hand on Dorothy's shoulder and gave it a squeeze. Let's explore our options then, Mr. Sorensen, shall we? And in the meantime, for a day or two, Dorothy can come home with me. Dorothy looked up at her with surprise. But I thought, it can't be permanent, she said quickly. I live in a boarding house, Mr. Sorensen, where no children are allowed. But my landlady has a kind heart, and I think she will be sympathetic. As I said, for a day or two. Mr. Sorensen stroked his mustache again.
Very well, Mrs. Larson. I will look into other possibilities and leave you in charge of Dorothy for a few days. Young lady, I trust that you will be polite and well-behaved.
Yes, sir,
Dorothy said solemnly, trying to hide the fact that her heart was beating hard again, leaping with joy.
Chapter 16. Molly, Spruce Harbor, Maine, present day. In Vivian's attic, Molly tugs the lid off a white cardboard box. Inside, all she can see is masses of tissue paper. She grabs a bunch of it, feels something heavy inside. The paper has been wrapped many times around whatever is in the middle.
Take care with that, Vivian says anxiously. I am taking care.
She makes her hands go slowly, unwinding what feels like miles and miles of soft, thin paper. Once she gets to the center, she finds a teacup, thin and fragile. Red roses bloom across the glossy surface of the china.
It's not broken, is it? Vivian asks, coming to hover over Molly's shoulder.
You think I broke it? Vivian looks down at her in surprise.
Gracious child, you're in a mood today. What's wrong?
Nothing, I don't break stuff. Molly sets the teacup carefully down on the attic floor and picks up another wad of paper from the box. Now she goes even more slowly, unwrapping the paper an inch at a time to find a little milk pitcher.
I know that. You don't think I've noticed that about you?
Vivian returns to her seat on an old chest.
Some people haven't. Molly mutters.
Which people are those? Molly unwraps another bundle, a sugar bowl. She sets it on the floor. Dina, she says, concentrating on her hands.
Your foster mother?
Molly makes a face. She's not any kind of mother to me.
Well, I won't call her that then.
The woman you're staying with?
I can't do anything right, Molly bursts out. She's mad at me about everything. No matter what I do, it's not good enough.
Molly waits for Vivian to tell her that she just has to try harder, be more polite, be a better kid. And Dina will magically turn into the perfect foster mom, because that's the sort of thing adults always say about other adults. But Vivian doesn't say anything like that. For a few moments, she's silent. Then she says,
life throws us together with all sorts of people, and we don't have much choice about most of them. Certainly not when we're young.
Molly glances over at her.
This isn't what she expected to hear.
People don't always give us what we need, Vivian continues, looking steadily at the tea set. Sometimes they just won't. But often it's because they simply can't.
Molly isn't ready to feel sympathy for Dina. Not yet. But at least Vivian isn't telling her that she'll magically come to like her if she gives her a chance. Molly unwraps and unwraps. A teapot. Two more cups. Soon the entire tea set is on the dusty attic floorboards.
Nothing's broken, Vivian asks.
Not a single chip in the whole set, Molly confirms. A broad smile crosses Vivian's face.
Now that is a lovely surprise. I never would have expected such a fragile thing to last so long.
Dorothy, Hemingford County, Minnesota, 1930. Miss Larson's boarding house was tall and narrow, light blue, with carved white trim around the roofline and the front porch. After the groats, it seemed like something from another world to Dorothy. She felt she should step on the wood floors gently so they didn't creak, keep her hands to her sides in case they smudged the burgundy wallpaper in the hallway.
"Wait here," Miss Larson whispered, touching a finger to her lips. She pulled off her gloves, unwrapped the scarf from around her neck, and disappeared through a door.
Dorothy perched anxiously on the edge of a horsehair armchair, ready to jump up again if someone arrived. After a few minutes, Miss Larson came back.
"My landlady, Mrs. Murphy, would like to meet you," she said. "I told her about your predicament. I hope that's all right. I felt she needed to understand why I brought you here."
Dorothy nodded.
"Just be yourself, Dorothy," she said. "All right, then, this way."
Dorothy followed her down the hall and through the door into a parlor. A plump woman with a fluff of downy gray hair around her face was sitting on a rose-colored velvet sofa.
"Well, my girl, it sounds as if you've had quite a time of it," she said, waving her hand for Dorothy to sit in one of the many chairs.
"Yes, ma'am?"
Dorothy glanced at Miss Larson, who smiled and motioned toward the chair beside her. As Dorothy took a seat, Mrs. Murphy said,
"Oh, you're Irish, are you?"
Her heart sank a little, thinking of Mrs. Groat's words.
"Yes, ma'am," she murmured.
Mrs. Murphy beamed.
"I thought so! Well, and I'm Irish, too. Came over like you as a wee lass. My people are from Enniscorthy. And yours?"
Dorothy's heart bounded back up again. "Kinvara in County Galway?"
"Indeed, I know the place. My cousin married a Kinvara girl. And you were christened, Dorothy?"
No, Neve. My name was changed by the first family I came to."
Dorothy felt afraid the minute the words were out of her mouth. She'd just confessed to being thrown out of two homes. But Mrs. Murphy didn't seem worried.
"I guessed as much. Dorothy is no Irish name."
Dorothy relaxed, just a little. Mrs. Murphy seemed to like her, or at least to like that she was from Ireland. So surely she would agree to what Miss Larson asked and let her stay. For a day or two, at least, and maybe, Dorothy dared to hope, even longer. Mrs. Murphy poured them both tea in cups painted with roses. Dorothy sipped hers cautiously, dreading what might happen if she spilled, or worse, dropped this beautiful piece of china. But nothing dreadful happened, and after the tea was drunk, Miss Larson took her up to her room. A tidy, bright little space barely big enough for a single bed, a tall oak dresser, and a narrow pine desk with a brass lamp. There were watercolor pictures of flowers hanging on the walls and lace curtains on the window. On the dresser was a photograph, in a frame, of a bearded man in a dark suit, standing stiffly behind a slim woman seated in a straight-backed chair. The woman, in a black dress, looked stern, but her bright brown eyes were familiar.
"Are these your parents?" Dorothy asked, shyly.
"Yes." Miss Larson came close and gazed at the picture.
"They're both dead now, so I suppose that makes me an orphan, too."
Dinner, which Dorothy and Miss Larson ate with Mrs. Murphy and the other four boarders, was at 6 o'clock. There was a bounty of food, a ham in the middle of the table, roasted potatoes, Brussels sprouts glistening with butter, a basket of rolls. Dorothy felt the pressure of tears in her eyes. She made herself eat slowly, savoring the saltiness of the ham, the softness of the rolls, the buttery crunch of the vegetables. After dinner, Mrs. Murphy showed Dorothy to a room of her own, with crisp white sheets on the bed, a pillow, and two clean quilts. Dorothy put out a shy finger to stroke the top quilt, touching the patches of blue and purple cotton. The little room was so clean and warm that Dorothy felt dizzy, as if she were floating. Mrs. Murphy handed her a nightgown, underclothes, a towel and handcloth, and a brush for her teeth. "The bathroom is down the hall," she said. "Go and run yourself a bath." Dorothy dropped her eyes to the rug. She knew she had to say something, but it was almost impossible.
"Gracious child, don't look so alarmed. What is it?"
"I'm afraid," Dorothy whispered with shame. "Maybe there are nits in my hair."
"Oh."
Understanding filled the landlady's face.
"Well, it's to be expected, isn't it? Living in that dreadful place. Are you sure?"
Dorothy shook her head.
"It's good to check, of course."
"I'm sorry."
"It's not your fault, child. Just wait here."
Mrs. Murphy bustled away, and a minute or two later, Miss Larson came in with a comb and a determinedly bright look on her face. Dorothy sat on the edge of the bed and bowed her head while Miss Larson tugged the comb through her hair. The girl gritted her teeth as the comb's teeth pulled through tangles and scraped across her scalp. After several tense minutes, Miss Larson sighed.
"Dorothy, I think you have nothing to worry about. Thank goodness. I'll tell Mrs. Murphy. You take as long as you like in the bath. Mrs. Murphy says that the others can use a different powder room tonight."
Tears of relief stinging her eyes, Dorothy clutched her towel and walked slowly down the hallway to the bathroom. Once there, she looked in the mirror. It was the first time since she'd arrived in Minnesota that she'd had a chance to gaze carefully at her own reflection. A girl she barely recognized looked back, thin and pale, with sharp cheekbones and matted red hair. Her cheeks and nose sore and chapped, scabbed lips, her sweater covered with an oily layer of dirt. Dorothy swallowed. Her throat hurt, and there was a dull ache in her chest as well. Maybe she was getting sick. She turned away from the mirror and ran the water in the bath. Once she'd scrubbed all the dirt off and rubbed soap furiously through her hair, she let the water drain out, then filled the tub again. She lay back in the warm water and closed her eyes. After a long time, she finally pulled herself out of the bath. She was so tired it was almost impossible to dry herself with the towel, pull on her nightclothes, and crawl into bed. And there's where she stayed for her first week at Mrs. Murphy's house. Dorothy slept and slept and slept, with the covers pulled up and the shades drawn. At some point a doctor came, put his cold metal stethoscope to her chest, and announced that she had pneumonia. Mrs. Murphy set a little bell by her bed and told her to shake it if she needed anything while Miss Larson was away at school. "I'm just downstairs," she said. She placed a pitcher of water and a glass by her bed and brought Dorothy bowls of warm chicken soup filled with carrots and celery and potatoes. When Dorothy at last felt strong enough to leave her bed, she found she had no clothes to put on. Mrs. Murphy had taken away the blue dress and the white sweater she'd been wearing when she arrived.
"Not even fit for the rag bag," she said briskly, when she got to Dorothy's room and found her sitting on the edge of the bed in her nightgown. "You come with me, girl. Let's see what we can do."
Mrs. Murphy led Dorothy, still barefoot, out into the hallway. Against one wall was a wooden trunk, which Mrs. Murphy pulled open. They both knelt down to peer inside.
"My boarders don't always take everything with them when they move on," Mrs. Murphy explained, lifting folded garments out of the trunk. "Sometimes they don't have space to pack everything, or something's unfashionable, or they don't care for it as much as they once did. But I keep it all. You never know what might be useful. Here now."
She held up a brown dress with pearl buttons.
"A bit big, I'm sure, but you know how to use your needle, don't you?"
Dorothy nodded.
"Take it in a little and turn up the hem and it'll do," Mrs. Murphy went on briskly. "And this will look quite lovely with that hair of yours."
A sky blue cardigan, embroidered with flowers, landed on Dorothy's lap. She'd never seen anything so pretty. There were stockings, too, and even a pair of black shoes. Mrs. Murphy seemed pleased.
"You'll look quite respectable and all that, I've no doubt. Go, put it on, child."
Dorothy's fingers shook as she did up the buttons on the dress and slipped on the sweater. The new clothes smelled of cedar to keep out the moths, and she told herself it was the smell that made her eyes water. But with her health and her new clothes came a new worry. This surely wouldn't last. Didn't Miss Larson say she could only stay for a few days? It had been more than a week. But she could not bear the thought of leaving. Mrs. Murphy really seemed to like her. Maybe, just maybe, she had changed her mind.
Chapter 17. Molly, Spruce Harbor, Maine, present day. On Sunday, it rains. All day. Dina's annoyed because she can't finish the yard work. Ralph has retreated to the garage and is tinkering with the car. Molly lies on her bed, looking at the ceiling, Anne of Green Gables face down on the quilt beside her. She's been in Avonlea all morning. Anne has dyed her red hair green, even worse than a blue stripe, Molly thinks, accidentally gotten her best friend drunk, and nearly drowned pretending to be the Lady of Shalott. Molly thinks Dina has it easy, really, with an almost orphan like her. She could have ended up with someone like Anne. But Molly is tired of reading now. And what else can she do? Her homework is done. It's not her regular day to go over to Vivian's, and she can't just show up there. Terry would probably have her arrested for trespassing. She can't straighten up her room anymore. It's as neat as it can get. She certainly can't call Jack. If only there was somebody else she could call. Megan? But Molly doesn't have her phone number. And even if she did, Megan probably thinks she's a freak after the way Molly ran out of the lunchroom when Megan asked her to go to the library. The library. Molly wishes she could go to the library. It was a good idea Megan had. To look for pictures to go with her portaging project. What if Molly could find photos of the place in New York where Vivian lived, or the ship her family took from Ireland, or the trains that all those orphans rode on? It would be cool for her report, and maybe she could even show Vivian. But she can't do it. She's not welcome there. Molly gets up and wanders over to her dresser. She brushes her hair and examines the fading blue stripe. She looks down at her necklace with its three charms, resting in a little bowl that Dina let her take from the kitchen. She goes to lie back down on the bed. She doesn't often think about the day the necklace became hers, but lying there with nothing to do except watch the rain splatter her window, she can't keep the memory away. It was the night of her 8th birthday. Her mother had made macaroni and cheese for dinner, and then the two of them had ice cream sandwiches and a Sara Lee cake from the mini-mart. Molly remembers squeezing her eyes shut, blowing out the pink stripy candles, and wishing hard for a bicycle, pink with white and pink streamers hanging from the handlebars. Then she'd sat on the couch waiting for her dad to get home. She remembers her mom muttering, pacing back and forth with the phone. She'd already called several times, but Molly's dad wasn't picking up his cell phone. "How could you forget your only daughter's birthday?" she hissed into the phone, as if someone was actually there on the other end of the line to be yelled at. Molly pressed herself into the couch cushions as hard as she could, wanting to disappear, wishing it wasn't her birthday. If it wasn't her birthday, her mom wouldn't be mad and her dad wouldn't be in trouble. The aftertaste of the sugary cake was sour in her mouth. After a while, Molly had slipped from the couch, put on her pajamas, and crawled into bed. An hour or so later, she was woken by a shake on her shoulder. Her father was sitting in the chair beside her bed, holding a plastic grocery bag.
"Hey, Molly Molasses," he whispered. "You awake?"
She blinked and nodded.
"Hold out your hand."
She did, and he pulled three little cards out of the bag. On each one, a small charm was wired into place.
"Fishy?"
he said. handing her the small, pearly blue and green fish.
Raven.
The pewter bird.
Bear.
A tiny brown teddy bear.
It's supposed to be a Maine black bear, but this is all they had,
he said apologetically.
I was trying to figure out what I could get you for your birthday, and I was thinking, you and me are Indian. Your mom's not, but we are. So let's see if I remember this right.
He moved over to sit on the bed and plucked the bird charm out of her hands.
Okay, this guy is magic. He'll protect you from bad spells and stuff.
Then he picked up the teddy bear.
This fierce guy is a protector.
She laughed, relaxing. Her dad was home. Now her mom wouldn't be mad anymore. Everything was all right, and it was okay that she'd had a birthday after all.
No, really. He may not look like much, but he's fearless, and he'll make you brave, too. All right, now, the fish. This one might be the best of all. He'll give you the power to resist other people's magic. How cool is that?
She smiled sleepily. But magic's not real, just in stories. Her father's face grew serious.
No. There's a real kind of magic, Molly Molasses. You're old enough to know about it now.
She felt a thrill that climbed up from her stomach, hearing her father say that.
It's not like bad spells. It might be stuff that looks real good and sounds real nice. It might be, oh, I don't know, like maybe somebody telling you it's okay to steal a candy bar from the mini-mart. You know it's wrong to steal a candy bar, right? But maybe this person has a lot of magic and he's saying, oh, come on, Maul, you won't get caught. Don't you love candy? Come on, just one time.
He wiggled the fish in his fingers and pretended that it was talking.
No, thank you. I know what you're up to. You are not putting your magic on me. No, sir, I will swim right away from you. You hear?
Molly smiled. Her dad smiled back.
But now you're protected from that sort of magic. Nobody can make you do stuff you don't want to do. Nobody can tell you who you are. Nobody but you.
2 weeks later, coming home late one night, he died in a car crash. Her mom became too depressed to take care of her. Within 6 months, Molly was living with her first foster family. There were three more families after that, including now Ralph and Dina. Molly lies on her bed thinking about her life, thinking about bad spells and bravery and magic. Then she goes to the garage to see if Ralph can give her a ride into town. Dorothy, Hemingford County, Minnesota, 1930. When she was finally better, Dorothy rode to school with Miss Larson. Back at Mrs. Murphy's house, she set the table for breakfast, cleared the plates, swept the hall, and helped to wash the dishes after dinner. No one asked her to do any of these things, but she was determined to show Mrs. Murphy how useful she could be. She told herself not to hope, but a week at the boarding house turned into two, then three. Maybe, Dorothy thought, Mrs. Murphy would simply forget that she didn't belong there. But of course, she didn't forget. One afternoon, when Dorothy returned in the car with Miss Larson from school, Mr. Sorensen was standing in the front hall with Mrs. Murphy, holding his black felt hat in front of him like a steering wheel. Dorothy's throat closed up so sharply that it hurt.
"Ah, here she is," Mrs. Murphy exclaimed. "Come, Neve, into the parlor. Join us, please, Miss Larson. Tea, Mr. Sorensen?"
Mrs. Murphy gestured toward the rose velvet sofa, and he sat down heavily. Miss Larson and Dorothy settled in the chairs across from it.
"I don't know."
The girl glanced out of the window at the trees with their tender green leaves as Mrs. Murphy bustled back in with the rose-painted teapot on a tray.
"Let's go back to Dorothy, shall we?"
he said.
"Easier."
Miss Larson looked at Dorothy, and the girl nodded. She knew there was no use pretending she had a choice. Mr. Sorensen cleared his throat.
"Why don't we get to it?"
He pulled a paper out of his pocket.
"There are several ways to proceed,"
he said.
"First, we can send you back to New York, or we can attempt to find another home,"
he sighed heavily.
"Which, to be frank, might prove difficult. We've had two failed attempts at placing you already. Trouble with the woman of the house. In both places."
Dorothy felt herself shrinking in her chair, but Miss Larson sat up, stiffly. Surely, Mr. Sorensen, you are not blaming Dorothy.
Mr. Sorensen sighed.
Ms. Larson, I am merely being honest. Twice Dorothy has been asked to leave a home. Regardless of who was truly to blame, this complicates a third placement.
Dorothy knew this was true. It didn't matter if the Burns were bankrupt or if Mrs. Grote never wanted her at all. All a new family would see is a girl who was told to leave. Twice.
Mr. Sorensen, surely there's a family, Miss Larson began.
He held up a hand.
Miss Larson, please, let me finish. Mrs. Murphy has brought something to my attention. A couple named the Nielsens, friends of hers, owned the general store on Center Street. 5 years ago, they lost their only child.
Diphtheria, I believe it was. Poor thing, said Mrs. Murphy.
Yes, yes, tragedy,
said Mr. Sorensen.
Well, apparently they've been looking for help with the shop.
Mrs. Murphy poured more tea into Mr. Sorensen's cup.
I told Mrs. Nielsen about you, Neve. I said that you are a sober-minded girl, 10 years old, and mature for your age. I have no doubt you can be of use to her, and so they have agreed to meet with you.
Dorothy knew she was expected to say something. She raised the corners of her mouth into a smile.
How kind of Mrs. Murphy, Miss Larson exclaimed. That's wonderful news, isn't it, Dorothy?
Yes, thank you, Mrs. Murphy,
Dorothy said, choking out the words. Chapter 18. Molly, Spruce Harbor, Maine, present day. With cold rain pelting the hood of her jacket, Molly stands on the sidewalk in front of the Spruce Harbor Library. Behind her, Ralph pulls away from the curb. He said he'd be back to pick her up in an hour and a half.
Maybe this isn't such a good idea.
Molly is tempted to go get a soda at the Rite Aid and just wait for Ralph to come back. She checks her pockets. Darn, only a quarter and a nickel. The rain is the kind of persistent downpour that finds every weak point in your jacket, drips down your neck, soaks your jeans, from the hems up. Molly's shoes are already wet. She's getting soaked. She needs shelter, and anyway, she's sick of feeling like a coward. She heads toward the library doors and shoves them open.
Maybe, she thinks, Mrs. LeBlanc isn't working today.
Then Molly can just sit down at one of the computers and get to work. But of course, she doesn't have that kind of luck. The first person she sees when she walks into the library is Mrs. LeBlanc, behind the checkout desk. Mrs. LeBlanc sees Molly, too. She narrows her eyes. There are two computer terminals on a table to the right of the checkout desk. Both are occupied. A boy, probably high school age, is playing a game. An older woman with stiff, permed hair is energetically typing. Molly spots a piece of paper taped to the wall above the monitors. It says, computer sign-up sheet at the front desk. 2 hours maximum. No exceptions. Great. Now she'll have to go right up to the desk. If Mrs. LeBlanc hadn't already spotted her, Molly would be tempted to turn around and leave, no matter how wet she'd get. But that would make her look like a total idiot. Her stomach flopping inside her like a fish on a line, Molly walks up to the desk. She said. Her voice comes out as a squeak. She clears her throat.
Can I sign up for a computer?
Mrs. LeBlanc has smooth black hair, cut just a little longer than Molly's, with a few strands of silvery white. She's wearing heavy silver earrings and a blue blouse the color of the sea. She nods at the sheet on a clipboard by her elbow. Molly picks up a ballpoint pen and writes her name. Is she imagining it, or is Mrs. LeBlanc eyeing her backpack? She's tempted to slink over to the computers and wait her turn. But then, she thinks of the charms from her father. Bad spells. Bravery. Magic. I'm sorry, she blurts. She meets Mrs. LeBlanc's eyes and notices that they are a clear green behind her glasses. About the book. I really am. I won't... I mean, you don't have to worry about that. Anymore.
Mrs. LeBlanc gives her a measured smile.
Well, Molly, I appreciate your apology, she says. It's not easy to do that.
A tiny hint of respect seems to have crept into her voice. Molly smiles back. Thank you.
You have a community service assignment, I hear. How's that going?
I'm almost done with the 20 hours.
Then we can consider the matter closed, I think.
Molly's stomach settles down.
Are you here for schoolwork? Or for yourself?
Something for school, Molly says. A history report.
Well, a computer's free now,
Mrs. LeBlanc points at the teenage boy walking away.
Can I help you find anything?
Molly tugs a notebook out of her backpack.
There's this ship? It came here from Ireland. I was hoping to find a picture of it.
What year? Molly flips the notebook open to check the date. 1929.
Well then.
Mrs. LeBlanc stands up and steps out from behind the desk.
Let's get started.
Molly sits down at the computer, and Mrs. LeBlanc pulls up a chair beside her.
This ship, did it dock at Ellis Island?
I think so.
All right, let's begin with the website for the Ellis Island Museum.
Mrs. LeBlanc helps Molly find a section called The Passenger Search.
It'll be fine from here, I think, she says. Come back to the desk if you need more help.
After she leaves, Molly finds a ship search button. She clicks it, checks her notebook, and types Agnes Pauline. The screen opens to a long list of passengers. Molly scrolls down, reading the names. And then she nearly jumps in her seat. There they are. Vivian's parents, Patrick and Mary Power from County Galway. It's as if characters in a book suddenly walked off the page, as if Mary or Dickon greeted her by name, as if Anne waved to her on the street, or Mrs. Lynde leaned over from the next computer to peer at her screen. She tries something else. Patrick and Mary Power, Fire, Elizabeth Street, 1929. On a site about tenement life in New York City, there's a picture of an old newspaper with an article about a fire. Patrick and Mary Power and their twin sons, Dominic and James, perished. There's no mention of Maisie. That's odd. Maisie died in the fire, too. Why wouldn't the newspaper article say anything about her? Molly clicks back to the Ellis Island site and looks up the passenger records again to make sure she's spelling the names right. Patrick and Mary Power and their four children, Neve, Dominic, James, and Margaret. Margaret. Maisie's real name was Margaret. Molly types some more, but she can't find any additional information about Margaret Power, who died in a fire in 1929. She thinks back to other names from Vivian's stories. Maybe she can find out what happened to Miss Larson? It wouldn't be just for her project, either. Vivian would like to know. It would be like a present Molly could bring her. But Molly doesn't know the teacher's first name. She'll have to ask Vivian. Molly flips through the pages in her notebook, searching for other names. What about those neighbors? The ones on Elizabeth Street, the ones who took Neve in after the fire? The Schatzmans? Maybe the tenement site will have something. She types in, Schatzman, Elizabeth Street, New York, 1929. A new page pops up. Someone named Liza Schatzman organized a family reunion in upstate New York a few years ago and created a page of family photographs. One is a brownish-colored print of a stern-looking man and a smiling woman with a little girl on her lap. The caption below says, Agneta and Bernard Schatzman and their daughter, Margaret. Photo taken at their home, 29 Elizabeth Street, New York. Margaret's original family died in a tragic fire when she was very young, and she was not expected to survive. But those of us who know Margaret won't be surprised to hear that she didn't give up easily. When she came home from the hospital, very much alive against all odds, Agneta and Bernard adopted her as their own in 1930. Molly sits back in her chair. Maisie. Maisie didn't die in the hospital. Maisie survived the fire, and when she came home, the Schatzmans took her in. Molly types frantically, Margaret Schatzman, Maisie Schatzman. The same family reunion page gives her what she's looking for. A photograph of a white-haired woman, 82 years old. Margaret Reynolds, maiden name Schatzman. She's surrounded by children, grandchildren, great-grandchildren at her home in Rhinebeck, New York. Maisie lived her whole life not 8 hours away from Spruce Harbor. What else can Molly find out? She types eagerly, Margaret Reynolds, Rhinebeck, New York. A newspaper article pops up. Molly's heart, beating fast, suddenly plummets right down to her toes. Mrs. Margaret Reynolds, age 83, died peacefully in her sleep on Saturday after a short illness. She was surrounded by her loving family. The article goes on, but Molly doesn't want to read it. Maisie survived the fire, but she didn't survive her eighth decade. She's dead for real this time. Molly is surprised at how terribly sad she feels. She leaves her computer and dashes over to the desk to find Mrs. LeBlanc again. "Can I print something?" she asks breathlessly. Mrs. LeBlanc nods. "A dime a page." Molly digs in the pockets of her jeans, pulls out the quarter and nickel, plops them on the counter, and hurries back to her computer. She prints 3 pages from the site that show the pictures of Maisie and her family. But she isn't sure what to do with them. She doesn't want to upset Vivian. Should she show her the pictures? For that matter, should she tell Vivian about Maisie at all? Chapter 19. Molly, Spruce Harbor, Maine. Present day. It's Monday night, and Molly is doing a sheet of math problems at the kitchen table. Actually, what she's doing is staring at her paper and thinking about Margaret Reynolds. Maisie Power. Her discovery at the library the day before sits in her stomach like a stone. She wishes she could ask somebody for advice, but who? Ralph? Lori? It doesn't seem right to tell anyone else before she tells Vivian. If she tells Vivian. If only she could call Jack, but Jack's still mad at her. That afternoon, he walked past her lunch table, again, without a word. She pokes her pencil at the paper and snaps a point right off. Ralph comes into the kitchen, headed for the refrigerator.
"Math?" he asks, looking over Molly's shoulder. "I hated that."
"That's why I do the budget," Dina says from the sink, where she's running water over the dinner dishes.
"So how's it going?" "Mol?" "Earth to Molly,"
Ralph asks. She looks up. "Okay." She pulls her backpack out from under the table and digs through it, taking out books and folders and stacking them on the table. "What's that?" Dina says sharply. She has turned around and is wiping her hands on a dish towel. "What?" Dina takes 2 steps over to the table to snatch a book from the pile.
"Where'd you get this?"
she demands, waving Anne of Green Gables in Molly's face. Molly's stomach sinks. She'd forgotten the book was in there.
"Molly?"
Ralph is looking worried. She sits up straight. "Vivian gave it to me." Dina flips through the book. "Says right here it belongs to Dorothy Power. Who's that?" Molly opens her mouth and shuts it again, dumbstruck by how complicated it's going to be to explain who Dorothy is. Dina turns to Ralph. "She stole from the library, and now she's stealing from that old lady. Or somebody else, maybe, some kid at school." Molly looks at Ralph. "I did not steal that book." He runs a hand through his hair.
"It does look kind of bad, Molly."
"Kind of bad?" Dina snorts. "You can call Vivian," Molly insists. "Ask her. She'll tell you." "Ralph, I can't put up with this." Dina raises her voice. "I told you one more problem and she's..."
"Dina, calm down,"
Ralph interrupts. His tone so firm that both Molly and Dina are startled. Dina closes her mouth so abruptly that Molly can actually hear the click of her teeth. But Molly can finish Dina's sentence for herself. She's out. Molly gets up and heads for her room, leaving the book on the table and Dina and Ralph glaring at each other. In her bedroom, Molly hauls her L.L. Bean duffel bags out from under the bed. She opens dresser drawers and scoops up socks and underwear, dumping them on the floor by the bags. T-shirts next, jeans.
She can hear voices from the kitchen, but she's not listening to the words. She knows what they're saying already. Dina insisting that Molly has to go. Ralph giving in. There will be phone calls, discussions, arrangements. She's heard it all before. Molly grabs shoes from under the bed, purple flip-flops, a pair of black sneakers from Walmart, and sets them in the bottom of the red duffel bag. She's learned to put heavy stuff on the bottom. It will keep her things neat and in order, everything where it should be. She rolls her black jeans and black t-shirts and puts them carefully in place. Whatever happens, she'll be packed and ready. But she'll never get done with her portaging project. Never finish her hours in Vivian's attic. Will she get to say goodbye to her? And what about Jack? Is she going to leave town with her one friend still mad at her? Sitting on the floor by her duffel, Molly tugs her phone out of her pocket. She wants to call Jack. But what would she say? Apologize? Ask for help? Explain that she's about to get kicked out and only called to say goodbye? She can't do it. Suddenly, she remembers the necklace. She drops the phone in the duffel and darts across the room. Maybe she's going to leave her friend behind, but the charms have to come with her. She picks the necklace up from its little dish and clasps it carefully around her neck. Her throat aches fiercely, but she's not going to cry. She never cries.
She didn't steal it, Dina.
Ralph's voice comes through Molly's door so loudly and clearly that she sits on her bed in surprise.
Mrs. Daly says she gave the book to Molly. Molly didn't steal anything.
Well, Molly hears Dina sputter, she stole that other book.
She made a mistake, and she's paying for it. People deserve second chances. We took her in, Dean. We made a commitment to her. I want her to know she has a home she can count on.
There's a knock on Molly's door. Come in, she says. Ralph stands in the doorway, looking in at the packed duffel bag on the floor, at Molly sitting rigidly on the bed.
Hey,
he says gently.
What are you doing?
The ache in her throat is so sharp she can't speak. Ralph comes over to sit beside her.
You don't have to pack up,
he says.
I called Vivian. She says she did give you that book.
Told you. Molly whispers.
Yeah, you did.
Ralph nods.
Molly, I want you to stay here. With us. We hope you will.
We? Molly says.
Yeah, right.
Dina is in the doorway now with Anne of Green Gables in her hands. Her eyes are oddly bright. She blinks hard. Here, she says. And walks over to hand Molly the book. I'm sorry, I jumped to conclusions. She looks at the half-packed duffel. Don't leave that stuff all over the floor, she says. It's a mess. Put it away before you go to bed, okay? Ralph smiles at Molly and gives her a little wink. She smiles back. Okay, she says. Chapter 20 Molly, Spruce Harbor, Maine, present day. That's it, Molly thinks. Done. Standing quietly with Vivian, she looks around at the attic. Every single item in every single box has been taken out, dusted off, and discussed. A few things were thrown out, a few more brought downstairs to be used. But most of the stuff stayed right where it was. The attic is clean, just not cleaned out. Molly recycled some of the boxes that were old and crumpled or torn. Terry got her new, sturdy ones, and then Molly rewrapped and refolded and repacked everything Vivian wanted to keep. She labeled it all by place and date with a new black Sharpie and taped a list from her notebook on each box to show what was inside. If Vivian ever needs to find anything now, she'll know right where to look. Mission accomplished, Vivian says, nodding. It seems to Molly that something more should be said. It wasn't just Vivian's attic they went through. It was her whole life. How about a cup of tea? Vivian turns and makes her way down the staircase. Molly follows. When Terry brings a tray into the living room, Molly is happy to see, instead of the usual thick white mugs, the fragile flowered teacups and teapot she and Vivian found in the attic.
Vivian fills a cup with amber tea for herself and another for Molly.
So you're done up there? Terry asks.
Molly nods, a little nervous, but Vivian gives Terry a big smile.
It's just as I want it to be, she says firmly.
Terry shakes her head a little.
You're the boss, Vivi,
she says, and goes back to the kitchen. Vivian turns her eyes on Molly.
I'll sign those papers for you, she says. You put in more than 20 hours, and do you have any questions for me?
Molly thinks about Maisie. She still doesn't know whether it would do more harm than good to tell Vivian the news. For now, at least, she decides to keep quiet. Besides, there is something she wants to know. She sets her cup in its saucer, careful to do it gently so the tea won't slosh or the porcelain won't crack, and digs her recorder out of her backpack. What about the Nielsens? What happened with them? You have to finish the story. Vivian smiles and leans back in her chair, her own teacup still in her hand.
I'm glad you want to know.
Did you meet them? What were they like?
Yes, I met them. Mr. Sorensen came back, and Mr. and Mrs. Nielsen came with him.
Dorothy, Hemingford County, Minnesota, 1930. Dorothy greeted Mr. and Mrs. Nielsen in Mrs. Murphy's parlor while Mr. Sorensen and Miss Larson stood quietly behind them. Mr. Nielsen, Dorothy thought, looked like a large gray mouse. He even had the twitching whiskers. Mrs. Nielsen was frail. Her dark hair was pulled back in a bun, and her lips were painted with dark red lipstick. Mrs. Murphy poured tea and handed them a plate full of biscuits. First they chatted about what kind of winter it had been and how lovely it was to feel the warmth of spring. Then they started asking questions.
What are your special skills, Dorothy?
I can sew, and I'm quite neat. I'm good with numbers, she told them. Mr. Nielsen, turning to Mrs. Murphy, asked,
And can the young lady cook and clean? Of course, she is a hard-working girl, I can tell you that, Mrs. Murphy said.
Does she go to church? Mrs. Nielsen asked.
Dorothy remembered clasping her grand's hand as they walked to St. Joseph's, right in the center of Kinvara. The smell of incense and lilies. But Da didn't hold with religion, and when they moved to New York, Mam couldn't manage to pack up 4 children by herself on a Sunday morning. Dorothy hadn't been to church since leaving the village. She wasn't sure how to answer Mrs. Nielsen's question.
She's an Irish girl, Viola, so I imagine she's Catholic, Mr. Nielsen said.
Dorothy nodded.
Well, we will expect you to go to Lutheran service with us on Sundays, Mrs. Nielsen said.
Dorothy nodded again. 1 hour of Protestant church on Sundays was a small price to pay, she supposed, for a safe place to stay. The Nielsens looked respectable. Perhaps there would actually be a warm bed, food to eat, clothes to wear. Of course, Mr. and Mrs. Byrne had looked respectable, too. Dorothy knew better than to put too much faith in what she saw.
We will send you to school in town here, a short walk from our house, so you won't attend Miss Larson's class any longer, Mrs. Nielsen said.
Miss Larson said, I believe Dorothy was about to outgrow the schoolhouse anyway. She's such a smart girl.
And in the afternoons after school, Mr. Nielsen said, you will be expected to help in the store. We'll pay you an hourly wage, of course. You know about the store, Dorothy, do you not?
Dorothy nodded and nodded and nodded. The next morning, Mr. Nielsen pulled up in a blue and white Studebaker with silver trim. Mrs. Murphy had gone through her trunks and her attic, and now Dorothy had 2 suitcases full of clothes and shoes. Miss Larson pressed a green hardcover book, Anne of Green Gables, into her hands.
It's my own book, not the school's, and I want you to have it, she said,
as she hugged Dorothy goodbye. And so, for the 4th time since she set foot in Minnesota, everything Dorothy owned was loaded into a vehicle, and she was on her way to somewhere new. Molly, Spruce Harbor, Maine, present day.
And that's all? Asks Molly.
All?
Vivian sets her teacup down. Well, no, not quite. I was only 10 years old, you know. I've lived more than 80 years since then. But in some ways, I suppose it is the end of the story. That